nationwide. We bring you latest current issues, discussions and information. Nationwide on Radio Miraya.
Hello and welcome to the first hour of Nationwide. My name is Sani Martin. Our discussion this evening will be focusing on the ongoing fighting in Sudan. The situation in the region, specifically Sudan crisis, continues to top the news headline around the world. And we in South Sudan have a specific interest, not only because of our history, but for all our citizens who are living in Sudan. And according to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the UNHCR, representative in South Sudan, Marie-Helen Vanni, she says there are 804,000 South Sudanese who are registered as refugees in Sudan, of which 191,000 are living in Khartoum and more than 290,000 are living in the White Nile State. And there are probably many more living in Sudan who are not registered. A South Sudanese political analyst, Census Loli Young, although she is working in the U.S. lately, has been watching closely events back home. Ms. Leung believes that her Sudan and South Sudan are intertwined through history, culture. Silencing the guns in the Sudan is very important for South Sudan and the neighboring countries. Please remember, this is a recorded program. Do not call, as we hear more from Census Loli Young.
I am from South Sudan, and I was in South Sudan in 2013 and 2016 when the conflict broke out. It was one of the most scariest moments in my life. And as I look at what is going on in Sudan at the moment, I feel as though for most of us, it brings back trauma of the experiences we went through, but then also that fear and worry for our family members. And, you know, although South Sudan and Sudan separated into two countries in 2011 after the referendum, truth be told, our countries are still connected, intertwined with one another. And we have a lot of citizens from South Sudan who live in Sudan. Others who went there during 2013 for safety reasons, and others who never left. And then you have others who came in recently for education purposes. As such, it is very worrying. It's also more worrying when you are far away because you do not have that first-hand knowledge. You don't have that first-hand knowledge and you rely on what other people are saying. But then you also know that a lot of the people, they are destitute and need help. And therefore, you try and look at ways that those of us in the diaspora can help, whether it's donation, whether it is by advocating for peace, whether it's by advocating for humanitarian aid, and doing our best to keep it on the news.
How does the situation look like from the other side of the ocean?
Very horrific. You look at the bombings that are happening in Khartoum, and remember, Khartoum has never been bombed in this way before. And so this type of conflict is actually new to people in Khartoum, because Khartoum has always been the safest space. Another part too is that when you have two warring parties that are well armed, you know that they will destroy whatever they need to weaken the other group. And this means it's almost as if it's a fight to the death for the two warring parties. But sadly, civilians are the ones caught in between. Civilians who have no voice and who do not have anyone advocating for them. And within that, you have those who have the wealth and money and are able to vacate and leave Sudan and go to bordering states. But then you also have those from South Sudan who, some of them are there as refugees, others never left Sudan. And you also have the new group that came in that are accounted for. We know we're told that there's about 1.5 million, but then the numbers, considering those who are also there that weren't fully documented, would come up to about to 2 million or above, and some of them want to come back home, come back to their towns and villages in South Sudan, but they do not have access to funding. They can't buy a ticket. They cannot pay for that transportation. As such, there is a full international movement that is happening where people from different parts of the diaspora are coming together and putting in money to evacuate people. In fact, with these ones that are being done, it doesn't matter who or what you are, for as long as you want some form of access to transportation, they are working to do that. And this is also done across all the different continents and with coordination from people within South Sudan as well as South Sudanese in Sudan who know the environment and who know the ground better, because we believe they're able to advise on what is the best plan, whether it's using river transportation, whether it's using buses, trucks, and then even access to airplanes. How do people get that? Do this need to be chartered? How much is it going to cost? Where does the support come from? So there's a lot of that work happening. And the most sad part about it is that when the conflict started, the government of South Sudan did not pick up the baton and said, okay, we have people there, how do we get them back? The only thing they said was, we are not going to act and we don't have any money and we are only concerned about the oil fields. We are only concerned about the economic losses. We believe they can do more. They can assist with coordinating. They can assist with providing some kind of security with immigration support in these bordering towns that have people coming in, because it's not only South Sudanese who are coming in, it's also people from neighboring countries who are leaving Sudan and coming in through the borders up in Upper Nile or the borders with Bahar Ghazal. And I think it's important to remember that conflict, war, is part of our history. And in fact, the ailments and issues that arose during independence were never solved. As such, it continued into conflict between the southern people in Sudan and the main government until finally the southern people separated as one nation. Now, you also find that within Sudan, since this was never sorted out, those difficulties, those disagreements, and those misgivings still exist. But one of them is really that everyone wants to be identified as a bona fide citizen with full rights and access to the country, to resources of the country, that they are identified, they are respected, and they are represented in the different parts of the government. And this is the crux of it. This is the crux of it. And it is sad that even though Bashir was imprisoned, removed from his position as the president and imprisoned, and there was a push for a civilian government, that civilian government did not hold because the military council wanted to ultimately be the one in control. And as such, the voices of the people was quashed. And it was not only quashed by this military group, but it was also the fact that international bodies gave recognition to the two warring parties. They were given recognition and accepted as those leading the country. And there was some form of comfort in accepting that, not even questioning that these are highly armed entities, that they are in fact all students of the former president Omar al-Bashir, and therefore whatever stain has existed from him continues. It does not end until there is a full shift. And then on the other end, I think it's important to remember that we even see that in Sudan, in South Sudan, because we are in fact two faces of one coin. Whatever happens within one country affects the other. We feed and coexist within that region, and therefore we are intertwined, and the, you know, a vision for peace ultimately requires a shift in how the region governs itself.
What is the way forward?
I believe, and I think this has been echoed by a lot of other international analysts and strategists, that the way forward needs to first start from the region. I think it's important that South Sudan, which was formerly part of Sudan, play a big role in this discussion and in this negotiation with the two leaders, because they know the two leaders better than other people. And therefore, they will honestly cut to the chase with all that other diplomacy and just say, let's put all our cards on the table. This is what's going on. We can shift, change, and all become productive as two countries. In the international front, I think the one of the countries that perhaps has more power would be China. China is respected by the two warring parties, and China is one of the biggest economies that interacts with Sudan, including the fact that China had a role in brokering peace between Iran and Saudi Arabia. In a way, China does have a big role, and perhaps also has the ability to hold them to their word. Now, do you expect accountability from China? I think looking at the fact that China is most of the time concerned with the economy and does not want to get involved in the political front, that might not be the case. But I think it's important to reach to China and try and access that diplomatic front. Now, in terms of Western nations, I think the United States by far has the greatest amount of power to push the two warring parties in Sudan to come to the table. In fact, I think they can increase sanctions. You know, some certain sanctions were lifted before. I think it's important to push for more sanctions. And I think the other part too is be serious, because the U.S. gave both of these entities legitimacy. And that is very, I think that's where a lot of citizens of Sudan lost hope, was the way they were given legitimacy and therefore allowed to rule. And I think the U.S. needs to explore all the different tools and resources it has to look at what modalities exist to tighten the rope on Sudan and to prioritize the citizens. In fact, I think really that is where the crux of the matter is. It's about prioritizing citizens. And also focus on sanctions on banks that are being used to launder funds, tighten the networks of these international financial systems, as well as incentivize the ongoing struggle. I think these are very important points, and these are points that are echoed by a lot of different entities.
Can we trust regional political actors, especially in Sudan and South Sudan, to deliver?
Well, here is the thing. Conflict in Sudan has implications on South Sudan. If we look at the economy, if we look at the plight of the citizens, if we look at the poverty rate, and if we look at the fact that there is a lack of basic resources for citizens within Sudan, and that's the case, that it's worse in South Sudan. I think the other part too is that with the current Boko Haram insurgencies going on in West Africa, once you open up that route of Sudan, in fact, what you do is you allow this conflict to engulf a huge part of Africa. Another part too is peace is inevitable for our survival, for the survival of countries in that region. For even those presidents, they need a peaceful country for their economy to flourish. And so if they want to stay alive, they would work much harder to have a peaceful settlement in Sudan.
How about development in South Sudan? How could events in Sudan affect us?
South Sudan currently rely on 99% on oil exports. And with this conflict in Sudan, a lot of the crude buyers are in fact now battering on how much price they're going to pay per barrel. before it was $100 per barrel, and we see what Minister Makwei said, that it has now gone down to $70 per barrel. As the conflict increases, this is going to get worse, meaning the amount that's coming into Bank of South Sudan is going to decrease, and that means the elites that have been enjoying these funds will not even have any funds to enjoy. So I think that part is disturbing. The other part, too, is that I think some of the telltale signs that people need to watch out for is when employees from the oil field, foreign employees from the oil field, start evacuating. I think that is a very worrying sign, because some of those employees are needed to run the oil fields. With less funds coming into South Sudan, South Sudan will be forced to rely more on international partners, and the international partners are already concerned and have been holding back because of lack of a peaceful settlement between the two main entities in Sudan, within South Sudan. And it's just going to require people to tighten their belt, but then also that means that you'll have an increased number of people who are in food insecure, increased number of people who are dying from hunger, lack of access to resources, and a very dark time for South Sudan.
What about the constitution-making process and the elections?
Constitution-making process and election requires peace. I think when such governance processes are pushed during a time of conflict, it does not lead to good results. In fact, it leads more to fragmenting the country. And so I think, honestly, the first part that needs to happen is for both parties to come to the table and start agreeing on, in fact, I think it's just follow what was agreed on in terms of the transitional government and start following all of those structures, start putting them into play. Creating a constitution, amending a constitution, is a very big process. It's not something that happens within a year. In fact, looking at how fragmented our country is, you would need large teams to travel to every village to have a huge public participation process of informing people what is the constitution in itself and what role do they have in shifting or changing how that constitution will be affecting their lives. And you also need to have your citizens all in one country for you to do that. But when a bulk of the citizens are stuck, refugees in neighboring communities, in neighboring countries, are stuck in other parts, and even within the country itself, do not have access because of the regions they are in, then what you are doing is not it's not a process out of concern for your citizens. And I think that's one of the cracks of the matter, is that the government exists for the people, and if the people are not all there, then that government is not necessarily fulfilling its mandate.
What is your message to the leaders and the people of South Sudan?
My message to the leaders and the people is that we need to value our citizens. We need to value our nation. It's a beautiful country. It is diverse. It has the ability to progress into something greater. It also has the ability to have diversified economies so that people do not only rely on crude oil. I think there is also a process of making sure that everyone understands that we all belong, and that building a nation, it's a process. It's not once off. We all need to come to the table and care for one another enough to want to rescue one another and protect each other. I think that part is important. And for the government, I think the government really needs to do more and just understand that being in government is not a lasting position. Therefore, be kind to those who are part of your citizenry. Therefore, prioritize them and push for changes in the system that will create an equal and equitable society. And lastly, to all those who are working very hard to get a lot of our citizens who are stranded in Sudan, I just want to say kudos and thank you. I can't imagine how all of you are feeling. I think the most difficult part is, as much as you want to see this happening from the government, when it doesn't fulfill that mandate, it makes you feel as though you are abandoned. But as we can see, citizens from all walks of life are coming together to save their own brothers and sisters and bring them back home. And this is very commendable. This is very commendable that I really believe it should be in every news channel, which is that citizens are coming together and working for change. And, you know, if we are all able to come to the table to do that and rescue them, we are therefore able to come together and rescue our nation from collapsing and rebuilding South Sudan to a country that we all belong, we all see our identity, that is prosperous in terms of the economy, and that is peaceful.
Anything else you would like to add?
We are all praying for a peaceful settlement to the conflict in Sudan, that we stand in solidarity with the citizens of Sudan, and that we have been through more. It's nothing to be glorified. It's very destructive, and it breaks down families, and that is something that is very difficult to build up again. We want to see more support from the humanitarian agencies. It took 15 days for them to come to Sudan. And even the type of support that's being offered in the border between Sudan and South Sudan, I think more can be done. We have seen reports coming out about the medical crisis within Sudan itself, and that doctors need assistance. This is something that could have been done from the beginning when the evacuation started. We also see that at the border with South Sudan, there is a need. There is a humanitarian crisis building up. There is a need to provide people with shelter. There is a need to provide people with food. And there is a need to attend to those who are sick. Therefore, there really needs to be urgency. We are not seeing that urgency. This is what is, I think, perhaps very concerning. And lastly, one of the things that you get to realize after going through multiple conflict is that sometimes evacuation is not the best option for you. And so I know during the conflict in South Sudan, some of us stayed in. We didn't evacuate because, as much as, you know, it's great to leave, there is also that unknown when you get there. How are you going to survive? How are you going to feed yourself? What support systems exist that can help you flourish, that can just help you survive? As such, I know that a lot of the groups that are working, some of the things that they're looking at is how do they just help people get out of Khartoum into the neighboring states where there is some form of calmness. And so perhaps they can stay there for a while before they come back to their homes in the city. I think I would echo the cries from everyone, which is that we are all humans. We want to see the same type of urgency that we have seen in the Ukraine conflict. We want to see the same type of access given to refugees as we have seen in that conflict. And we want to see all of that support. And we hope that this is taken seriously because the situation is deteriorating. Ceasefire is not holding, and there doesn't seem to be any movement of negotiating teams going into Sudan to sit with the two warring parties. We know that this is happening perhaps through other model of communications, but you know, people need to start moving. This process needs to be curtailed before it gets any further.
Before I let you go, today is the World Press Freedom Day. Any thoughts?
I would like to honor my late brother, Alfred Taban. He was one of the first Southern journalists working with BBC World Service. Through him, we were able to know and understand what was going on in the civil war between Southern Sudan and the Sudan government under Omar Hassan al-Bashir. Through him, we received factual news on the ground, and he was persecuted a number of times for the chances he took to bring that news. Not only did that happen in the Sudan, but also when South Sudan became a nation. I want to honor him for all the struggles he went through to bring to us factual news regardless of persecution. I also want to honor the American journalist Christopher Allen, who was killed while trying to cover the conflict that happened in South Sudan during the conflict. I want to honor him, honor his life and his legacy, and that he went far and beyond to bring such crucial news. I also believe it's imperative that radio continues to operate, because there are certain parts of the world and in all our countries where it is perhaps the only way for people to receive news. May all this news be factual, because it also has the ability to become propaganda and lead to more death.
That was Census Lo Leong, a South Sudanese political analyst, talking to me on the line from the U.S.